Good morning. You are tuned in now to Unceded Airwaves on CITR Radio 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia.
Unceded Airwaves is an Indigenous radio collective comprised of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people chatting about news, politics, art, and everything in between.
My name is Eleanor, and I'm one of your hosts today. I'm a settler with European heritage. I grew up on Okanagan territory in the interior of BC, and I now live here on Musqueam territory in Vancouver.
Tansi Samantha Nianitsi Kesan, Dawson Creek Otsi Nia, Nia Michifisqueo, Kuna Nasgot Mitanawa Musqueam, Ekoise. My name is Samantha. I'm Métis. I grew up in Dawson Creek, and I am here with Eleanor to talk about this interview.
Today's episode features an interview with Morning Coup, which is the project of local musician Chandra Melting Tallow, who's from the Siksika Nation. The interview was created in part as my intervention project for a course in the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program at UBC, FNIS 451, Indigenous Feminisms. The purpose of the intervention project is to take the principles and practice learned in Indigenous feminisms beyond the classroom to engage with family, friends, peers, or community members. The main goal of my intervention was to center the voices of Indigenous women and to center them within my community here at CITR. At the end of the episode, we will also hear a piece of poetry that is the result of my classmate and Unceded Airways member Matt Andrietta's intervention project. The poem was written through a collaboration between Matt and an Indigenous woman who was chosen to remain anonymous. All right, so a little bit more about the interview. A couple weeks ago, Sam and I sat down with Chandra to talk about her new album, Baby Blue, about being an artist in the city, and about how she got her start as a musician and as an artist.
Eleanor invited me to participate in this interview with her, and I was very interested to talk to Chandra just about being an Indigenous woman in Vancouver and an Indigenous woman creating this really rad music that kind of breaks a lot of molds in what you think of Indigenous art and music.
Yeah, it was really, really fantastic conversation. I felt so lucky to have Chandra's story shared with us. So,
yeah, she was very generous with her words.
Yeah. In between the discussion that we had in the interview, there's also some live recordings from the album release show for Baby Blue, which was on November 20th at Horses Records. So you'll hear those throughout the interview. After that, Sam and I will be back to talk about upcoming events and news making headlines this week. So stay tuned for that and enjoy the interview.
Thank you. My name is Chandra Meltingtallow, otherwise known as Pony Boy, and my family's from Siksika, which is part of the Blackfoot Confederacy. I'm a local musician, artist, and semi-professional lip syncer. I'm trying to push the lip syncing career a little.
So when did you first start making art?
I started, well, actually I never really thought about being an artist until, or like considered it until I was 17, when my dad, such a cheesy story, but like my dad took me to the, he lives just outside of Washington, D.C., and he took me to the Museum of Art, like the big one, and I went and I decided that I wanted to be a painter. And so I went to ACAD like 5 years later because I had dropped out of high school and then kind of like did whatever for a while. And then I went to ACAD as a mature student. And while I was there, I completely lost interest in painting. And I started doing performance and installation work. And then from there, I went to Concordia, and that's where I got way more into installation and sound. Then I started doing sound. I think like noise was like a pretty big thing in Montreal at the time. When I moved to Montreal, I hadn't been making music yet. Like I'd done a couple sound collages and I really liked making those. But I think because there was a noise scene, I really liked doing audio work, I started doing a bunch of that too. My dad gave me some synthesizers for like my 18th birthday, so I just started messing around with those. And I think because like noise and electronic music and gear is like pretty accessible and closely related, that's, it's just like evolved into like making electronic music. Like I didn't really anticipate being able to do that. But I'd always wanted to be a singer, but I had completely given up on, like, I didn't even consider it, like, a thing at all. But, like, I've always, and I think with Morning Coup, I would consider myself more of, like, a producer and a vocalist, and, like, I'm not really focused on getting really good at playing the keyboard or the guitar. I'm just more interested in learning the basics, but, like, I think as a vocalist and producer, those are like my focuses.
It seems like when watching you perform, like you have such an intimate relationship with the stuff that you're using, like the equipment, and you taught yourself how to use all of that, right?
Yeah.
What was that like?
I think it was pretty intuitive. I just taught myself a lot of the stuff. And I've had that gear for like 5 years, so I've just kind of messed around long enough that I've figured it out. But I think maybe it looks like I have an intimate relationship because I'm so nervous when I'm playing that I'm just like so focused, because there's like so many little things that I'm doing, and I'm like trying to think about the vocal parts as well, because a lot of the things that the melodies that I come up with are pretty challenging to sing, so I'm trying to like split my brain with like pulling off these like really like,
you do,
yeah.
Yeah, you're very focused, but it's very like natural and just, it's fantastic. That's awesome.
Oh cool, thanks. Yeah, it's nice that it looks so effortless because I'm like so stressed the whole time.
Was curious about your like artistic process in terms of making music.
Yeah, because I kind of like made it up as I went along. Like now the system that I've developed, but I think I'm gonna change it for this next one because I want to try something new. But for that album, the songs were all composed while I was recording, so I would just kind of, well, some of them were like jamming, like there's a few. But towards the end, I would just, like, come up with, like, the bass of the song and recording by, like, trying out different things. And, like, there's a couple on there that were just one take. Like, I just made it up on the spot, and then it was like boom, 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 and then I did the vocals, and it was done. But Baby Blue and Burn One for the Saints and Somnium were ones that, like, completely changed, and I worked on, like, I think Baby Blue took 5 months, and Burn One for the Saints took about 4 months. I can't remember Somnium. It was too long ago. So I would just, like, rearrange parts and, like, move them around, or, like, completely take out a synth line and put a new one in, or, like, change the drum beat. And then the melodies, like, the vocal melodies changed so much. Like, they kind of drove me completely insane. But I would just, like, come up with a melody, and then the very last part, like, the last step was, like, the lyrics or, like, the songwriting. But now I want to try the opposite, writing, so, like, songwriting, and then doing the melody, and then putting the music under it, which I've never done before. Mm-hmm. And I want to do that for this next one.
So, Baby Blue, it came together over 5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a long time to, like, create something. And how did it feel releasing those into the world after you'd spent so much time on them?
Well, I was really scared when I realized, like, people could listen to it. Like, I felt a little weirded out.
It's really hard sharing.
Yeah, because it had been so long. But it wasn't supposed to be 5 years. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to, like, I put, like, hastily put together an EP in 2010 that Aaron Levin, when he first started Weird Canada, asked me to send to him. And then I was going to, like, re-release it because I wasn't happy with it. I didn't like it. He said really nice things, but I was like, it wasn't quite what I wanted. But then when I got back, like, because I went to field school, and when I got back, wasn't doing well, and, like, it was just one thing after another after another, and I had to go move back in with my mom, and then I was living in Calgary, and I kept, like, pushing back the date, and then also I was, like, reworking all the songs, and then once I'd make, like, a new one, I wouldn't like the other ones, and then I was just also, like, getting better at it, and then it's really challenging, I think, when you're, like, trying to figure out how to take care of yourself when you're living with a disability, also how to, like, I don't think putting out a record was accessible to me at all. Like, I didn't have the resources. I didn't have, like, the capacity to be able to, like, you know, put it together and put it out. Like, I think it was just wasn't really possible for me. And I'm really grateful because I think if it hadn't been for the support that I had in the past couple of years, like, I might still be struggling with it. Or maybe not. I'd probably be on Bandcamp. But I think, like, the support that I had from people made it happen. Because it got to a point where I was like, I could just, like, not put it out. Like, what does it matter? I was, like, so frustrated. Thank you.
much of your career, I guess, has been kind of away from home, and I think there's been a lot of talk, I've heard recently about Indigenous art and Indigenous aesthetic and what that means in the arts.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was wondering, like, how you feel, like, maybe if, like, you carry in, like, Blackfoot aesthetic or different Indigenous aesthetics into your art and creation.
Yeah, well, I think when I was in the early beginnings of, like, experimenting and exploring with my visual art practice, I think there was definitely, like, an Indigenous aesthetic, and I was addressing a lot of Indigenous issues. But I think at some point I started to feel and, like, kind of resent that that was what was expected of me, or that non-Native artists wanted to see that from me. I think I, like, started to feel a little bit confused by it, because I want to, like, that's such a big part of my identity, and I want to address, like, issues that are really important to me, or, like, it's also, like, just so a part of who I am that, but at the same time, like, I don't want to be tokenized, and I feel like, especially because, like, when I was, like, just going to art school, like, being a Native artist was so hot. It was like, you know, and we got a Native artist, and, like, I don't know, I just felt really conflicted about it, and I still do in some ways, because I feel like it is a good thing that people are interested in these issues, and it is a good thing that there's space that's being made within the contemporary arts community, which is predominantly white, for Native people. But at the same time, it's like, at what point does it become, like, I don't know, it's so complex, and I don't think it's, like, it's either one or the other, but when something becomes popular and, like, a little bit trendy, then it can take away from, like, the root and, like, the actual, like, source of what's being explored or what's being talked about, and, like, then it's, like, becomes commodified, and I think that's quite dangerous. And so I think, like, I really wanted to, like, just for a bit there I took, like, quite a bit of a break from visual art, and I actually was like, I'm not making art anymore, but then it's like, of course, like, I am. But I think I just wanted to take a step back and, like, think about, like, what I wanted to make without paying attention to any outside noise or, like, what was going on, and really think about what I was making, not in response to what, because I didn't want to make something in response to those expectations, whether it was, like, meeting them, which I wouldn't anyways, or, like, resisting meeting them, but just, like, doing something very intuitive. And I think what's resulted from that is the work that I've been making recently is, I feel, like, apprehensive to, like, talk about it too much, like, too in-depth. And I like that, and it's intentional, because I think there is an expectation within the arts community to, you know, have an artist statement and, like, to explain your work, and I feel, like, resistant towards that, because now the way that the work I've been creating has been evolving is, like, very spiritually based, and I feel like in respect to the work and with respect to the spirit world and to my relationship with my ancestors, I feel like it's part of creating that work to let it exist as that. And I feel like in that way, like, my values and my upbringing and my identity are, like, intrinsically a part of it, and that's kind of, like, how it evolved from there, and, like, it'll keep changing, and, like, I know it'll change, because I'm, like, constantly, like, switching around ideas and stuff, but that's, like, the place I think that I needed to come to take a step back. I think it's, like, complex thing. I don't think like there's any like right or wrong way, but I just like wanted to take a step back and just like look at all the different factors of what was going into making work as an Indigenous person in the arts community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always such a big conversation when you're an Indigenous artist, because people expect, like, they pigeonhole you, they tokenize you, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't create works that are explicitly what people assume to be Indigenous or follow like a specific kind of guideline for like producing what like Native art is supposed to look like, I think it freaks people out.
Yeah. And I kind of like freaking people out.
Good. Keep them on their toes. It's like, non-Native people in the art scene get a little weird when Native people start doing cool things that are like, no.
And going off that, in kind of like focusing more inwardly, how is it to like have stuff that's so personal then exist out in the world?
Oh, it's super weird. I like actually have been thinking about it a lot lately, and I don't really know how I feel about it. I feel pretty conflicted about it because on one hand, I think it's really important to share stories of survival, because those stories of survival are what helped me to survive. And I think it's a pretty big part of being a human. But I also feel trepidation of that being commodified as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't really, like, I think I'm just, like, starting to think about how to be able to toe that line. And, like, who... Because there is, like, a sense of entitlement, I think, amongst, like, Western capitalist society towards artists, be they, like, musicians or filmmakers or whatever, to their stories and their lives and their private lives. And so I don't really know how to toe that line, and I don't really want to silence myself also, but I also want to be able to keep that to myself and like share it, those experiences, with the people that deserve it. And I'm not really sure how that looks, but I feel like that's something that I've heard from other friends of mine who are like musicians and artists, so how to be able to like navigate that. Yeah, but I'm like also a neurotically private person, so it is pretty weird. Yeah.
Well, people get greedy with like stories and stuff too, mm-hmm. right? Like they just want, we think that we're so entitled to knowing so much, when really it's like every time somebody shares with you, you should be like so grateful, right? Mm-hmm. And don't take it for granted.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really looking like people, I feel, don't look at stories as gifts. Mm-hmm. And like I've always been raised that like when people tell you stories, like they're gifting you with something. Like you're going to learn something, like, they're gifting you a part of themselves, and, like, it gets weird, well, you're right, and, like, it starts being commodified, and it starts being, like, taken by other people and used in ways that you didn't, like, want it to be, so it's, like, weird to put those things out there.
Yeah. Yeah, because once it's out there, you can't retract it, like, you can't take it back, and I'm learning that really quickly, and, like, just, like, such a small scale. But I also do feel like it's so, I think, like, my instinct is to not share anything, but, like, do feel like because I've benefited so much from hearing about other people enduring experiences similar to mine, and I feel like without having heard about those, I don't know. Like, I don't think I would be at this point. I don't think I would have survived. And so I feel like that's really important, and it's also important for people to I feel like I want to share that experience as well, because I feel like one aspect of it is that when you're living with disability or like chronic illness, what so many people experience is that the pace of your life is like dramatically slowed down, and you're not able to keep up with the pace of society. Like, able-bodied people have a hard time keeping up with the pace of, like, Western civilization. So, like, if you're not, what you come up against is, like, pretty intense, and I think it's really hard for people who are able-bodied to be able to conceive of that, even though these conversations are, like, coming to the forefront and, like, being, like, such a big part of dialogue. It's still hard for people to know what that looks like interpersonally or in everyday life. And so I think, especially because there's such an emphasis on getting things done in your 20s, like, that's an indicator of your value as a person. If you, like, get, if you're, like, established in your 20s and, like, you're worthy of being out in the world. But I think, like, obviously in my case, like, it just wasn't accessible for me to put out an album until I was 30. And if I were to listen to that narrative that's been given to me my whole life, then I would feel really bad about myself. And, like, I have that inclination, but I just won't. Like, I refuse, because it's, that narrative is a lie. And I feel like for other people who struggle, not just with, like, disabilities, but who are marginalized in any way, like, it's important to keep that in mind, that this is, like, an old story that we need to unlearn, and just, like, it goes in the garbage, it's useless, it's stupid. It's, like, and I think, like, hearing about other people who, like, struggled and then weren't able to, like, really do work until later was helpful for me. And so I think that's, like, my motivation for wanting to share that side. But I do, like, there is a part of me that does want to, like, I don't know if you can, and, like, I don't, these are just, like, ideas that are floating around in my head, but I don't know if you can, but I, one part of me wants to be able to keep that conversation separate from the work, but I don't know if that's actually possible, because I might just be, like, completely intertwined, and maybe they need to be, but I also am interested in the idea of, like, the work being separate from the person. I would say my grandmother is a really big part of this album. Like, my family, but my grandmother was a really big part of it. She, like, because the album is, I would say, very spiritual, she helped raise me, and she instilled that relationship that I have with the spirit world, like, from a very early age. And, like, all of the themes that I explore are things that I learned from her. And also, that period of time was so challenging and so difficult, but I learned all of my resilience from her, because she experienced so many hardships, but it was just never a question for her whether or not she would endure it. And so I think, like, in that way, like, the record is, like, she's a really big part of it. Her name's Diana Maltingtallo. She lives in Calgary. I miss her.
Beautiful. I think the, like, spirituality and just, like, the connectedness and just, like, the richness of that really comes through in the album. Like, cool. I listened to it and I was blown away.
That's nice.
Yeah. I think for our communities, art and music and just, like, song and dance have always been a way of, like, talking to our ancestors and just, like, making sure we're all connected to all our relations. And like you're saying, in the Western world, that doesn't really come through because, like, it is very secular, and I think it's very beautiful and very important.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. That's... it's... the creative process is, like, so much a part of that. And I think that's why, like, I am even apprehensive to even feel like I can fully take credit for the work on the album, because I feel like so much of it was, like, a part of that relationship and an exchange. Yeah.
Thank you.
over 30 years, there has been one voice in the local Vancouver art scene that has stood above the rest, and that's Discorder, that conspiracy, punk rock, foxcore, sassy, still publishing magazine from CITR. We're one of the established and trusted voices of Vancouver's music and arts culture in the Lower Mainland, with 8,000 copies distributed monthly to over 135 distribution locations, from the Lido to Zulu Records.
Discorder is one of a few magazines published by a community radio station, and we only serve up the freshest local and Canadian goods.
We have interviews with artists, album reviews, live show reviews, and articles about everything important to our crazy, unique, varied, and amazing culture in Vancouver and across the country.
Pick up your free copy of Discorder today, or sign up to have it delivered to your door wherever you are.
Check out our website for distribution locations and all the information about advertising and getting involved with Discorder.
Offered through the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program, FNIS 401G, Indigenous Law and the Settler State, is a three-credit course being taught by New Channel scholar Johnny Mack in Term 2.
This course will focus on the relationships between Indigenous law, state law, and policy, whilst taking up key issues of their legal agency in the lawmaking process. Please visit fnis.arts.ubc.ca for more information.
Every second Wednesday of the month from 6 to 9 is Women in Queer Night at the Bike Kitchen. Bring your bike and give it some love in this safe and positive space for anyone who identifies as female or queer. Come learn how to fix your own bike with the help of a female or queer identified mechanic and volunteers. Plus, there's free pizza. Visit bikecoop.ca for more information.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
All right, you're tuned in now to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territories in Vancouver. This is Unceded Airwaves, the radio show of CITR's very first Indigenous collective. My name is Eleanor.
And I'm Matthew Andrietta.
And we are hanging out in studio today. You just heard an interview that myself and Sam Nock, another member of the collective, did with Chandra Melting Tallow, and her project Morning Coup. It was really, really a treasure and a treat to sit down with her and chat about those things, such as her artistic process and her experience as an Indigenous artist in the city. So yeah, hopefully you all enjoyed that interview, and if you missed part of it or tuned in at the end or want to share it with others, it will be available on our podcast after this show is done today. So we got about 15 minutes of the show left here, and Matt and I are going to chat about some upcoming events and some things in the news before handing it over to Marie for her show Synchronicity that is on at 12. So what's coming up in the next couple of weeks, Matt?
Well, it looks like December 19th, we've got the North American Indigenous Winter Celebration. Actually, that's the 19th to the 20th of December. So the description here says, experience the culture. Join us for this free family two-day event. Cultural performers from across BC. Artisans with hundreds of gift ideas. Sounds like a really cool event, and that's at the Croatian Cultural Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like they have a really full schedule of a lot of different dance groups and other performers throughout the 2 days. And the fact that it's free is really, really awesome. If you go to the website, which is www.naiwc.ca, You can see the full schedule and some bios on the artists, as well as just more general information about the event. So definitely recommend checking that one out. At UBC this week, on Wednesday, December 16th, there is a community feast bowl happening in the First Nations Longhouse. It's being put together by the Indigenous Health Garden in collaboration with the UBC Farm. And this week they're serving food that is cooked with Oka. Is that how, do you know how to say that? OCA?
No, not really.
Oxalis tuberosa, which is a root crop. It's indigenous to the Andes, and we grow it at the UBC farm here. They're still looking for volunteers to help with cooking and preparation. So if you're interested in doing that, you can meet in the longhouse anytime after 9:30 in the morning to help cook. And then the lunch itself will take place at 12:30. And the meal is free and everybody is welcome. So if you're, maybe you want a study break from your exams or...
Sounds like a good break to me.
Yeah, or a paper writing break or something like that. Yeah.
Nice.
Cool. What other stuff is going on?
Let's see. Adam Sandler's movie just came out. And it's been pretty controversial. I've seen a lot of things about it in the news. For those of you who don't know, about a dozen Native actors walked off set feeling disrespected over the names of characters, specific scenes and things like that. And Netflix kind of brushed it off, saying it's just a satire, which was an answer that didn't really satisfy a lot of people, and understandably so. It brings me back to that quote, you know, where they say it's like, when you hurt someone... and they tell you you hurt them, you don't get to decide that you didn't. And I think that especially applies to people in positions of privilege and power, especially in media. So that's going on right now. I haven't seen the movie yet, but I don't know if I will. So we'll see.
Yeah. And it's like you were saying when we were talking about this before, there's a hard decision with things like this where things are being appropriated or handled in a really... unfortunate way.
Yeah.
And you have to decide whether you just give it zero attention and you just pretend that it doesn't exist, or you kind of try to engage with it in order to
show, like, critique it.
Exactly.
Openly.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a funny balance between boycotting something based on principles and kind of having a voice in that space where these very white people have claimed Indigenous voices.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that people walked off the set is pretty...
Yeah, it's a pretty powerful movement, especially in show business where opportunities like that don't come around all the time. Mm-hmm. I think that says a lot that they would take that initiative and walk off the set.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, well, something to think about. I would like to hear maybe some sort of critique done in the similar style of the people who put on the Métis in Space podcast who
I feel like we could devote an entire show probably to critiquing this movie.
Probably, maybe a future episode. Speaking of future episodes, in the coming weeks we've got some great stuff lined up for Unceded Airwaves. Next week, we have a Christmas special brought to you by Willow, one of the other members of the collective. That's December 21st. And then on December 28th, we will have an interview that our collective member Cora did with Bo Dick. And Bo is currently a artist in residence, I believe, here at UBC. And he's also teaching currently, or he was teaching a course this past semester.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, so Cora sat down with him to talk about all types of things, and I'm sure that that's going to be a really interesting interview as well.
Yeah, he's always an interesting person to listen to.
Have you done any lectures with him or?
Not personally, no, but okay. I've heard a lot of things.
Cool. So that's on. That will be on the 28th. I think I just said yes. And then on January 4th, we have a plan to do a episode on queering resurgence. So that should be really great as well. All right, so got about 10 minutes of the show left here today. As we mentioned at the beginning of the episode before the interview with Chandra, that interview was created in part as part of an intervention project for the course FNIS 451, Indigenous Feminisms. Both Matt and I took that course.
It's really amazing.
Yes, it was a great course, great class. Very glad that I took it. So now we're actually going to hear, as I mentioned in the beginning of the episode, Matt's intervention.
Yeah, I collaborated on a poem with an Indigenous artist who chose to remain anonymous, and I respected that and edited the voice and left her name out. So it was a really interesting process for me, and I'd like to thank Dr. Sarah Hunt for teaching this course and allowing us to have this opportunity to bring our theoretical work out of the classroom and into the real world.
Yeah, totally, totally. It was really, it's something that you, not enough projects do at school, I find.
Yeah, it's a lot of time spent in class, and then at the end of the day, you're kind of left with that question, now what?
Exactly, or like, how do I take all this stuff that I'm learning that I think is really important and talk about it with my peers or my community or my family?
Without coming off as pretentious and
yeah, totally. A lot of the other interventions that our classmates made were also really, really incredible.
Yeah, it was really amazing to see all those minds at work.
So if anybody listening is interested in taking an FNIS course, there are many excellent ones to choose from, but definitely recommend Indigenous Feminisms for sure. Great. Okay, well, we're going to hear from this poem, and then that will be kind of it for us today. But thanks all for listening, and you can check us out on Facebook, on Seated Airwaves, or on Twitter, and follow us for updates and podcasts and things like that.
What I became. Coarse sand of cockle shells resting on the shore. Burning driftwood smoke and smells die out in the dull gray roar of semi-trucks and buzzing cars hurrying their way through town, with clouds of black blocking out the stars and moonlight dancing down. Through neon lights and city nights, I'll dig my feet into the sand. With fallen kites and mosquito bites, I'll know this is my land. A subtly torn and broken place granted unto us, a bullied, worn, and shut down race thrown into our dust. A soaring bird cuts through our sky and curves down into the sea. A crescent moon stuck in my eye as I sit beneath your tree. You told me how and showed me when to look up at the cloud and taught me more what I knew then. Don't let others say when you're allowed. The tracks we left upon that land will stay through death and time. No words or theft or steel hand will tell me what is mine. A broken chain, which once was strong, hangs dangling in the wind. For one man's gain, we all were wronged and told that we were those who sinned. My dark brown eyes will change no more. My skin will stay the same. I'll learn the ways of ancient war and show you what I became. As long as rivers flow and grass grows green, you said this would be mine. But with all I know and all I've seen, in this God's country, he hasn't been here in quite some time. So cut our trees and throw your trash along this privileged land, and know that with wounded knees and a beaded sash, this is where we will stand.
Bye. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Mu'kmaq.